From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The acclaimed founder of the Einstein Institution, whose book, From Dictatorship to Democracy, helped in part to inspire the Arab Spring Revolts, has died. Gene Sharp passed away on Sunday, January 28th at his home in Boston. He was 90 years old. Considered the godfather of the nonviolent resistance, Gene Sharp spent decades studying with the care and methods of a scientist, major and minor revolutions and uprisings the world over. In his 1973 magnum opus, The Politics of Nonviolent Action, Sharp explored in great detail the principles that help nonviolent resistance work, especially in the overthrowing of dictatorships by organized populations. The 900-page book also lists nearly 200 methods of nonviolent action culled from his studies. Sharp also wrote a number of other books and booklets, including From Dictatorship to Democracy, There Are Realistic Alternatives, and Waging Nonviolent Struggle. Gene Sharp spent 30 years as a political scientist at Harvard University's Center for International Affairs, and he co-founded the Albert Einstein Institution, a nonprofit group that he created in 1983. He was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize in 2009. On February 17, 2011, I interviewed Gene Sharp on my show, formerly known as Uprising. Today, with the presidency of Donald Trump adopting many hallmarks of dictatorship, and with the health of American democracy in peril, that interview, which will re-air now, continues to be deeply relevant.
Well, can you first tell us what the difference is between when one talks about nonviolence and pacifism? Words are important. You like the term political defiance. Why?
That is a term used not to confuse it with pacifism or ethical nonviolence, but to show its political resistance, and it's very gutsy. It was a term that originated in Burma, in speaking with some of the guerrillas there, a term that they could understand. They could not understand that nonviolence might be resistance. So that term, political defiance, was introduced.
So it was a term that originated in Burma?
Yes, used by Robert Halley. Colonel Robert Halley.
How has the history, the recent modern history of Burma, shaped your work?
Not really, except to show that some of the problems of introducing it to people who needed effective means of struggle were still very difficult, because many of the opponents of the military dictatorship in Burma had been supporting one or another of very small guerrilla movements and were sort of heavily wedded to violence. And other people favored nonviolence, as Aung San Suu Kyi, but were not really political strategists to plan out how to conduct nonviolent struggles skillfully.
Why is political defiance, nonviolent political defiance, more effective than armed revolution or coup d'etats or foreign intervention or any of these other means of changing regimes?
But those means don't always change regimes. Nonviolent struggle sometimes does, as in Tunisia and in Egypt. But if you are choosing to fight a military regime or a political regime which is heavily backed by police and military troops, then if you choose to use violence, you are choosing to fight with your enemy's best weapons. And it's not wise strategically to do that. Nonviolent struggle has a capacity to undermine the nature of that regime by taking away its sources of power, the belief it is legitimate and has a right to rule, taking away the obedience of the population, to focusing on resistance, social, economic, and political resistance, which the regime is usually ill-equipped to cope with.
You brought up Egypt and Tunisia, where you've been cited, your works have been cited as a major influence. But are you referring to the fact that at least in Egypt, the military taking power is may not necessarily be consistent with your philosophy?
They've used that as a way to deal with the emergency when the old regime has collapsed and there's not a new replacement regime sitting there waiting to come in. So they are hoping that the military will serve only as a caretaker government while elections can be held and a new constitution developed. I don't know whether that's wise or not, but that's just what is happening. And then people need to be very careful that the military do as they say they will, step aside when a civilian government is established.
Now, you also referred to the sources of power of a dictatorship. How do you describe the sources of power of a dictatorship? Is the biggest issue compliance by the population because of a fear?
That's one of the big ones. First of all, one is the legitimacy of the regime, the belief that it has a right to rule, to its position. And then there's the control of the communications, control of the economy, control of transportation, a civil service or government employees, the means of repression, the police and military. If it has all these, they're supplied by the population and by the institution, the civilian institutions of society. Then you have a chance of removing those. If you remove those, then there are people up there sitting in the presidential palace issuing orders, and in extreme situations, nothing happens when the orders are issued.
And when you have sources of illegitimate power like dictatorships, how should people treat offers of negotiation? Because usually when you have revolts after the denial of the revolt that it's even happening, oftentimes the dictators will or the regimes will try to have some kind of negotiation with protesters. But you warn against that.
It's very dangerous. Because in negotiations, the negotiations aren't a place where people evaluate the justice or injustice of each argument. Negotiations are places where how the argument is sorted out depends on how powerful each side is. And if the resistors are deemed to be weak, they will not have any leverage in negotiations. And the regime was very strong, and they can issue instructions and orders, expecting them to be carried out and nothing else. Instead, people need to calculate what are the alternatives? What is a nonviolent way of conducting the struggle, of bringing down the regime? And for that, then you need to do, as we've said, identify the sources of power. How can they be restricted, weakened? How can they be cut off? And then you have a chance of sorting out a better regime and not being able to negotiate. I'll go out, but you put my son in my place, who might be even worse.
I'm speaking with Gene Sharp, and we are discussing his works that have influenced some of the revolutions that are taking place in the Middle East now. Mr. Sharp, let's talk about the difference between the terms peace versus justice. Oftentimes, dictators and powers will use the term peace to justify injustice, because you know you might have peace, but it might be like a big prison. Why is it important to be wary of the term peace?
Because it can mean so many things, so many different people. For a dictator, peace means that everybody submits and does what they're told and behaves themselves. You know, some other people may regard peace as a wonderful future condition they hope to achieve. But maybe they're not quite sure how to get there. So I can talk of peace if I'm talking to a peace groups, but you have to do more than just use those words. You have to understand what are the peaceful or the nonviolent alternatives to violence, and how can those be waged? Because if Only if you have a real alternative to violence, an alternative that can be powerful and strong, will people really have a choice. They can choose that instead of choosing passivity or submission or violent struggle. And often they end up using violent struggle, and often those struggles are defeated by a strong regime.
In the case of Egypt, President Obama described or compared what was seen in Egypt with the civil rights movement and other nonviolent struggles. Does the nonviolent political defiance that you described, does it also help to create a sort of moral authority that in today's day and age, when we talk about democratic ideals, it's much easier to it's difficult to ignore the moral authority of nonviolent protesters.
Yes, but moral authority doesn't get you very far sometimes. You have to organize in such a way that you're able to wield power more than moral authority. Moral authority is good, but you have to deserve it for the first place, but you have to back it up with a political organization, political power, and power of the organizations and civilian population to conduct their struggles as they did in Tunisia and as they did in Egypt.
So let's talk about that. What are some of the important institutions of democratic power that are generally prerequisites for a nonviolent struggle for democracy?
Well, you have means of communication throughout the population in a great variety of ways, whether it's on the internet these days or it's in newspapers, radio, and television, some of which are always biased in a certain way, but all free information can often get through. That's very important. You have the operation of the civil service and all the people who work for the government and the government, and their willingness to continue those jobs is extremely important for an existing regime. There are other sources of power. These are outlined in some of my writings in my book, Social Power and Political Freedom, and the book on nonviolent struggle, which is called Waging Nonviolent Struggle.
You talk about methods of nonviolent protest and persuasion that are useful for democratic uprising. How did you come up with these? These are nearly 200 methods. Are these based on your own research of what has worked in the past?
Yes. And it's not only nonviolent protest and persuasion, but there's a massive class of non-cooperation, including strikes and civil disobedience and massive disobedience and nonviolent intervention, which ranges from sit-ins to establishing a substitute government. And those are based on some years of research. The whole second volume of my major book from 1973, The Politics of Nonviolent Action, the whole second volume of, 300 or some pages, but outlines those 198 methods with definitions, discussion of what they are, and historical examples with footnotes. So that is based upon reality, it's not based on someone's imagination.
So would you say that in writing the book, The Politics of Nonviolent Action, you kind of bring historical and even, if you will, scientific researchers' method to studying what works and what doesn't work in nonviolent struggles?
That's accurate. But those particular descriptions of individual methods, like general strikes, for example, that doesn't give you the full picture of what is going to work or not. There are several pages at the end of that book you cite about what are the factors that contribute to success and to failure. And there are a variety of those, I think at least 17 different distinct factors that are important. And if you do this skillfully, you have a chance of succeeding. If you don't do it skillfully, if people are frightened, or if they turn to violence, then there's a good chance you're going to fail.
And can you give us some examples of what are some of the biggest mistakes that can be made? Is turning to violence one of the big ones?
If your enemy is well armed with massive troops, tanks, and airplanes, and powerful police that obey all of whom obey your orders. If you're going to fight that system, you got the odds stacked against you. Mm. Why choose to fight with the weapons that your enemy has better ones for and stronger ones? You choose to fight psychologically, with social power, economic paralysis, and political non-cooperation, civil disobedience, undermining the morale of your opponent's troops, then you have a chance of winning. But not if you choose to fight the way he's going to fight.
I'm speaking with Gene Sharp, the author of a number of books. His 1973 book, The Politics of Nonviolent Action, has been an important influence, as has his book, From Dictatorship to Democracy. I want to ask you who your major influences are in your work. You run the Albert Einstein Institution. Is Einstein one of your major influences?
And personally, yes, and I'm going to be putting out a new booklet on the development of Einstein's thinking throughout his life, because he had to cope with the reality of the Nazis and so forth. But toward the end of his life, he became very interested in Gandhi and said that he was the man the most powerful in terms of thinking in politics that he admired. So I'll be doing that. But I don't have a messiah. I don't have someone who's inspired and causes me to believe as that person did. I tried to piece together pieces of the answer to grave political problems for which there didn't seem to be really big answers.
So in the research that you did, this very comprehensive look, is this the first time that that all of the various modern movements around the world had been studied and put together in the kind of way that you did? Was this the most comprehensive study of movements?
Possibly. But we need other people to examine this study and others that are really built upon that and to make their own evaluations. I don't like to be blowing my own horn, so to speak, so much, you know.
Sure. Well, this is Black History Month right now in February. Can you tell us what some of the lessons were that you learned from the civil rights movement here in the United States in terms of what worked and maybe what didn't work?
Well, prior to the civil rights movement, I was still in Europe. I lived in England and Norway for 10 years, and so I did civil rights types of things, lunch counter sit-ins and so forth, at Ohio, in Columbus, Ohio, before I went to New York and to Europe. But so I don't think I learned too much from the civil rights movement, except that this kind of thing is possible, that people have put up with the racial discrimination and segregation for many decades, could rise up and conduct resistance to bring an end to it, that was the main thing. But I also got inspiration from a variety of other people. When I lived in Norway, for example, I met people who had participated in the resistance under the Quisling regime with the Nazi occupation. And I've met people who have been taking part in other resistance in other parts of the world.
Have you yourself personally been involved in a struggle?
I did lunch counter sit-ins in Columbus, Ohio. I did picketing and protesting in New York. I practiced civil disobedience and military conscription and spent 9 months and 10 days in federal prison before I continued my studies.
And what do you make of, you know, here in the United States, most progressives in the United States, and today even some conservatives, have looked to the work of Saul Alinsky as a playbook by which to do organizing, political organizing. Do you have any opinions on Saul Alinsky's work?
Yes, I read his work many years ago. It seemed to be very useful and very important for people, social radicals, so people wanted to change economic conditions locally, and that's something that may still be worthy of examination.
And Jean Sharp, do you feel that your work is something that occupies a particular place on the political spectrum? I'm sure there's been many attempts to cast you as radical, liberal, progressive, etc. How do you identify yourself, or do you think that that a political identification is even worthwhile?
I don't think the political identifications work. One of the chapters of one of my books, I think it's Social Power and Political Freedom, is the need to rethink politics, because the old labels and the old analyses and the old slogans, they're not adequate anymore. We need to rethink that and form new ways of thinking and tacking on sometimes specific issues without a massive political ideology, such as Marxism or whatever.
Here in the United States, political discourse has really devolved, if you will. Are you hopeful, or do you feel that some of the lessons that you've drawn from your research of past uprisings can be applied here in the United States?
Yes, and you have to do it skillfully and thoughtfully, and not in terms of developing a new group of people going to believe all the same way. Working out. It's a different situation here in the United States than, say, it was in Egypt a year ago. Quite different. So you have to do things differently.
What are some of the things that you think, or what are some openings you think, or do you think the U.S. is even ready for the kind of nonviolent revolution for people to take back their rights, just given the huge inequalities between rich and poor, et cetera, today?
Yes, I don't think the United States situation is such that we can imitate the way things they did in Egypt at all. It's a very different situation. I think we have to tackle very specific alternative ways of dealing with particular problems, whether it's economic problems or whatever, and also think of new ways of defending. For the Defense Department talks about defense, but defense means protection, preservation. But the Defense Department and military, they are not always tuned in to defense, but often to military combat, sometimes for invading other countries and for a good reason, supposedly, and on down the line. And we need to rethink it. That we developed in the 1960s and 70s and later a new approach to defense called civilian-based defense. If you make your society such that it cannot be ruled by foreign invaders or people carrying out a coup d'etat in your country to oppose a new dictatorship, but those can be blocked by non-cooperation and massive defiance, and one can prepare for that. And American allies can learn how to defend themselves without military assistance from the United States, and that would greatly simplify the tasks of the U.S. Defense Department.
Now, finally, Mr. Jean Sharp, revolutions are hard to start, but often it's said that they're harder to finish. What does your research show you that what is it that works to preserve the kinds of freedoms that are won once a dictatorship is toppled? And of course, I know that goes into the realms of political organization and, you know, political forms of government. But are there any lessons that can be learned on how to sustain a revolutionary won freedoms?
Your first thing you must do, you must be able to block any other group, be it military or political, from using that confused situation when one regime falls apart to impose their new rule, whether it's a new military dictatorship, which has happened repeatedly in Egypt, for example, or whether it's a political dictatorship, which is what the Bolsheviks under Lenin did in October 1917. They seized control of a confused political situation because the Tsarist system had been brought down by nonviolent struggle. Not Lenin, he had nothing to do with that. And using this new nonviolent struggle, people did not know how to block a coup d'etat by the Bolsheviks. And that's what occurred, and that led directly to Stalin. And we have a booklet on the anti-coup, how to prevent coup d'etat, and how to block coup d'etat once it is attempted. We have a great deal of sources that people might find useful on our website. which is the website www.aeinstein.org.
aeinstein.org. And we link to that from our website as well. And then one last question to you. You are getting late in your life attention that maybe you didn't expect to get. Politico has written about you, calling you the most influential American political figure you've never heard of. And the Wall Street Journal did an article on you entitled American Revolutionary. How do you feel about this attention coming to you so many years after you've been writing about these things?
Well, it would be nice if my writings deserved attention. If it could have come some years ago, and our financial situation would not be as bad as it's often been and still is. But it's very gratifying if the work... See, this kind of analysis takes a long time. It's not some quick thing. It's not just writing an op-ed article, which takes time enough. The bigger studies like the ones I've done, like the politics of nonviolent action, or waging nonviolent struggle, or a book at Princeton University Press published years ago called Civilian-Based Defense, they take time, so you can't expect instant results, but it merits further work and attention with other scholars and thinkers to put their minds to work on these problems and the many problems that you can think of and I can think of with the application of these nonviolent means. And that is something that's very important.
Well, Gene Sharp, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and sharing your analysis. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're very kind. Thanks for doing some of your homework ahead of time.
Thank you very much. And we'll link to your website, aeinstein.org. And maybe listeners can also check out your website and support your efforts financially. I really hope so.
That would be very good. Thank you so much, and good to wishes to all your listeners.
You've been listening to a 2011 interview that I did with the pioneering theorist Gene Sharp, whose work on nonviolence inspired many movements for democracy. Gene Sharp died on January 28th at the age of 90. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.